I develop a story arc like a writer. I develop a process on how I'm going to funnel through the information. And then I ultimately decide, what do I think is going to grab people's most attention? And if I showed this to my friend and they read it, would they actually get what I'm talking about?
I'm your host, Adam Met, and today we're talking to Christy Drudman, the founder and face of Brown Girl Green. After working with many climate organizations, including Students Against Fracking, Christy graduated from Berkeley's Society and the Environment program in 2017. Just after finishing school, Christy created Brown Girl Green, a media hub which centers identity and self-care in relation to the climate movement. Christy not only wanted to create a safe space for people like her, but also wanted to ensure people were hearing the stories of people of color facing climate challenges. We talk about curating climate science for an online audience, reclaiming power from corporations, and fighting eco-anxiety. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And without further ado, here is Christy Drudman on Planet Reimagined. So Christy, welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
Amazing. So I want to get right into it because we have so much to talk about today. You graduated from school in 2017, but since then you've interned or worked at such a wide range of places. And I'm excited to talk to you about all of these different things, but I want to start with a really important piece of the conversation. You run a media hub called Brown Girl Green. It's a podcast, social platform, YouTube channel, articles, and a lot of other things. First and foremost, why is it important to have both race and gender as such a central part of this movement? And clearly it's incredibly important, or you wouldn't have included both of them in the title of your media hub.
I love this question. I mean, I think as a woman of color in the environmental space, I feel like talking about my own experiences of being a woman of color in this space was why I created Brown Girl Green, was feeling this isolation that I didn't see other people who looked like me in this space, didn't feel like I had a lot of mentors or educators or networks to feel like I could really succeed or thrive in this field. And that really frustrated me. That was at the root of why I created this platform, is because I met other women of color who felt similarly, felt like a lot of mainstream environmental platforms and narratives and spaces were not diverse and did not look like the people who came from our communities, even though I was learning during school about all of these Black, Indigenous, and people of color who live on the front lines of the climate crisis, who don't get the same kind of attention or space to share their stories or the same kind of recognition that they deserve. And so I feel like talking about race and gender is, in a way, a prognosis of this issue. And my approach of using my media hub and my voice as a form of medicine, I guess, to address that crisis that I feel is happening in environmental storytelling.
So I'm sure you've gotten questions similar to that a lot. And I just want to kind of flip it back on itself a second. Do you think that's a fair question for us to be asking in the middle of the climate movement right now? Or should we have all of these voices and it be such a range of people, it's not even necessary to ask that question in the first place about why it's important, and they should just be engaged from the beginning?
I mean, I think in general, like, it'd be really nice to live in a world where patriarchy was not harming me, where racism wasn't harming me, where sexism wasn't harming me. Like, it would be so nice if we lived in a world where it would be so common sense for people to not live with so much hatred, but that's not the reality of the world we live in. So we do need to talk about it.
Agreed. So now you are representing a range of different communities and you have such a voice in this movement. What is that responsibility like to be representing this range of communities?
Like people can probably find on my website, I call myself a Jewpina. So I'm Jewish American, I'm Filipina American, I'm second generation Asian American Pacific Islander, like all of these things. I'm also, you know, an educator and a speaker. So I take all of those things to heart, that these are all my identities that make up my role in the movement. And I think the responsibility I feel in that is, I don't want to say staying in my lane, but kind of realizing that in order for me to not feel burnt out from my activism, I felt like I needed to tap into what my strengths were to really bring to this movement, because I didn't feel like I could just be everything. I didn't feel like I could be someone fully mobilizing on the streets, or I didn't feel like I was fully that person who was shifting money and finances, or I wasn't that person who was doing international policy, even though, you know, down the line would love to do that too. I just wanted to make sure that I was operating out of a space of joy and out of feeling like I was contributing my best to the movement. And for me, that was through storytelling, through interviewing, through connecting with people and sharing that. So I never try to claim I'm something I'm not. And I feel like that's a part of my responsibility, is being very transparent about what I do and don't know, because I don't know everything. And I'm not going to say that I am the movement. I will never say that. But I would like to say that with having my platform grow as big as it has, and the amount of amazing people I've been able to connect with and connect those people with other people out in the world, I do feel like I have a responsibility to hone in on my strengths of operating that platform, to make sure that I'm, you know, citing my sources, to make sure that I'm always recognizing my own privilege in the space that I'm taking up, to make sure that, like, I'm sharing that space with people who are more marginalized than I am. So just trying to find that balance of both honing in on, like, these are my experiences of feeling oppressed and marginalized in this space, but also knowing that there are people that have it so much worse than me, and that I always have to, like, make sure that I'm reshifting that and being an ally myself too.
I want to talk about one of those strengths that you're mentioning. So on this podcast, we've talked a lot about the transition out of the information age and into the age of curation, which is, I think, a really important distinction for people to think about. I would call you, like myself, a curator of content in our fields in order to get people engaged. And I want to quote you for a second. You said, "Those of us using social media are trying to categorize everything to make it easier for people to get access." And I really like that. So I want to ask you, what are the benefits and drawbacks of giving people like you and me that power of curation?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I didn't even know I said that. That's awesome. Go Christy of the past. I don't remember even saying that. But I would just say that it allows the space for more resources to be put out there that people otherwise probably wouldn't have access to, or the news isn't covering. As we see even from the Yale Climate Opinion Maps of 2020, people are barely even talking about climate change, or even know that it's connected to human-made causes. So definitely recommend people check out the Yale Climate Opinion Maps. And so it's like, well, who's filling that gap of media information? If the news isn't covering it, if our classrooms aren't covering it, then where are people getting their information? It's maybe these news articles that are amazing outlets, but where are those outlets even getting circulation? How are they distributing their news outside of their target audience? And so I feel like for media curators, we are tapping in, finding that information that we find interesting, and being able to give it a new home to redistribute that information to people that otherwise probably wouldn't even know it exists. But with that being said, it's getting filtered through me, right? So similar to CNN or Fox News, they all have their biases, they all have their filters on what they prioritize and what they talk about. And when you are a small independent media entity like me, and I don't have a sizable, scalable team right now, there's only so much you can do. And so with that being said, the scope is limited. And so I always try my best to redirect people to other organizations who are talking about these things. I always tell people to follow other places. So I think the middle ground is, how are you also creating new signals to both the algorithm and to your audience to redirect them to more resources, organizations, and communities that they wouldn't know about? So that way you're not putting it all on yourself, nor should you put it on yourself to give all that information. It's actually even more important to amplify that ecosystem of who else exists who can also create those teachable moments and probably do it better than even I could.
I love that metaphor of an ecosystem because you see so many people jumping on the climate bandwagon in the last few years saying like, oh, climate is a space where I can invest a lot of money and make a tremendous amount of money, or I can become an influencer in the climate space. But really recognizing that you're part of an ecosystem that started decades, if not, you know, many, many, many decades ago. So I love that you're situating yourself within the larger conversation. And I want to dial into one specific thing that you mentioned. So I'm finishing up my PhD. You've been studying environmentalism for a long time, both in school and working with many different organizations. Where do you think academia fits into the environmental movement now? And what should it be doing differently?
I just view academia as a way to give people resources. Even in my experience as a woman of color, I think people do trust me more because they know I went to UC Berkeley. Like, there's a weird elitism to it where it's like, what if I went to a Cal State? Or like, what if I got a certificate, but I still developed an expertise in this? But it's one of those things where academia is still like a very revered institution. Mm-hmm. And so it allows people to have that kind of mobility and access to get those resources. And I know for a fact, at least from my experience, a lot of the things that I learned from my professors in undergrad are still things that I use to like create content. I take really dense academic journals that I still have access to, and I break that down into posts. People always tell me that, like, you just broke down a super complicated topic. Yeah, it took 3 to 4 weeks to do that. And I think that's an important thing to talk about. With a lot of the rich information I think is out there, especially by climate scientists and people that study this on an academic level, how are you making your information accessible to people? You're probably not, because you're focused on your dissertation. You're not making infographics. I've been contacted by some PhD students who asked me, how are you able to break down these really complex topics? Like, what has been the response? What does that look like? Okay, that's great. You're interviewing me for your research to examine how I'm doing that. But I'm like, could you do that too? Like, that'd be really interesting to collaborate with people in academia who do have this expertise to help make my content better and make other people's content better. It's been something that's been on my mind as someone who's come from academia.
I loved that. That was great. I have a couple more questions in this area because I'm really interested in it. Is that right? Is that what should be happening? Should academia need a conduit to the general public that is people like you? Or should academia really be focusing just as much on communication as it does on research? Or should that not happen? How should this work, in your opinion?
That's a good point. I mean, I think it's a balance. For such a long time, communications work in this space has been devalued. I can tell you that firsthand. I've been doing this for almost 4 years now, have explored climate communications for almost 5 or 6 years now, and I can tell you that people valuing this kind of work has only been maybe in the past year or two.
Definitely.
And so it's like one of those things where I find it fascinating that all of a sudden it's emerged this way, because there's still gatekeeping. There's gatekeeping around, well, are you allowed to talk about that because you don't have a PhD? People have told me that. They're like, you don't have a PhD. So I find that interesting, the gatekeeping around it. I would like to figure out how there can be more programs that are accessible to people. I mean, that's a whole other thing. Having access to higher education, period, it presents so many barriers specifically to Black, Indigenous, and people of color, period, outside of this space. So you're expecting, with all these barriers, for a young person of color to go into a field where they're not guaranteed to have a great return on their investment, especially if they want to go into communications. And you want them to go into debt to get this quote unquote PhD or master's degree to become an expert and join the other experts who are failing to communicate these issues to the general public. Interesting. So anyways, I get a little heated about this. I'm just saying, like, there needs to be more unity, right? Climate scientists, I think, are doing amazing work. And through programs like Yale and folks at George Mason, like, they're really trying to, like, figure out how to get this stuff right and down to a science, which I think is awesome. But there's also the people factor, the emotions, the storytelling. And I don't know how much of that has been thought about or invested into beyond those two programs I just mentioned in other realms of academia, of people who are coming up with climate tech solutions or carbon sequestration approaches, or, you know, talking about climate justice in theory, but not actually like talking to the people on the ground. I see so many of these gaps in relationship building that I just wish could be bridged more if people found more value in it.
Definitely. And so how do you determine the stories that you're telling, the amount of information and the information that you choose to pull out of these extremely detailed pieces of research? I mean, of course you can't communicate all of it. So what's your process like of saying, okay, I'm going to communicate numbers 1, 2, and 3, but I'm going to leave out 4, 5, and 6 because we don't have the space. And people's attention span, honestly, can't really accommodate numbers 4, 5, and 6 at the moment. So how do you make those choices?
I think the way that I go about it is I think about a story arc before I even go in to the data or the information I'm presented. So for instance, I made a really complicated post about climate resilience, but from the grassroots. And when you read the post on my Instagram, it looks pretty simplified down. It's a pretty good breakdown, in my opinion, of a very complicated topic where this organization I was working with basically came up with a program to be able to teach farmers how to grow their own crops, to be able to profit from it, but also in the process of that, teaching farmers how to also like be able to address natural disasters way before they hit and be able to prepare the soil in a way so that way it doesn't erode. And it's like this whole complex thing they call a golden nexus. Suffice to say, we don't need to go into all the details of that. But what I'm trying to say is this organization gave me this really dense article that explained their process. And I had to somehow figure out how to turn that into a 10-slide carousel. And I started off by realizing, okay, well, what's the thing that appeals to me the most just hearing about this without even reading this? And it was like, oh, this is a climate solution. Great. Okay. So I need to explain how it works, why it works, who says it works, and how can people get more involved? And from there, I was like, I don't know what's going to fit in all those buckets, but let me figure it out. And then I broke it down, and then somehow, magically, through the work of me and my amazing team members, we were able to put together something really cool for that. What I'm trying to say is I develop a story arc like a writer. I develop a process on how I'm going to funnel through the information. And then I ultimately decide what do I think is going to grab people's most attention. And if I showed this to my friend and they read it, would they actually get what I'm talking about?
That's a great point. And using somebody like that almost as a focus group, I think is really helpful because like we were talking about before, especially in academia, you're surrounded by people who have the same types of backgrounds and the same types of viewpoints on things. So showing it to people who don't have expertise in these areas, I think is really important. I want to jump into the resilience question because you brought it up. Resilience is, like you said, it's really complicated. And so much of resilience is focused on policy. And you focused more on the grassroots side of educating individuals about it. So I'm going to read you one more quote by you.
Oh, wow.
Environmentalism is not just fighting the big, mean corporate power of the fossil fuel industry. It's also reclaiming our power to protect and restore our communities to be in better harmony with nature. How do we make that happen? How do we create that balance between naming and shaming, but also making sure corporations are making changes with reclaiming the power of individuals, like the example you were just talking about with farmers and resilience?
I love that question. Like I said, you can't just keep things on social media. And I think everyone has a role to play. Like I said, I view my platform as a starting point for people. But I always tell people these platforms and these things need to be used as tools to organize and connect with others who are actually challenging systems of power if we're really going to see changes offline on the ground. And so I think it's that balance where I always try to provide kind of a comfort space for people to feel like they're not alone. But I also try to push people out of their comfort zone to recognize you always need to like be pushing yourself to do more. I think it's a balance. Like, we can't remain complacent and afraid, but we also need to do whatever we possibly can too. So it's both of those things. And I think that's part of the reclamation piece is like, if you think it's inevitable, then it's going to be inevitable. And I think that that is the lie that we are sold right now as a society. And I think if people really realize, like, we have big corporations literally paying millions of dollars into market research to get into like the brains of Gen Z to understand what do we care about. They're doing research into unions to actually understand, are these unions a threat to their companies? They are scared of the prospect of being called out and torn down. And so I hope people just recognize that the reclamation of the power is pretty much at the core of calling these things out.
Absolutely. Self-care really is a big part of your platform. So I want to talk about that for a little bit, because on social media, you are really addressing individuals. You know, at its core, you're talking to individuals. And yes, at a larger scale, you do work to hold corporations and governments accountable, but you are really focused on individuals. And you said that you give them a place to, you know, be themselves. And self-care is a really big part of that. Can you talk a little bit about what self-care really has to do with the climate crisis?
Yeah, like I said, a part of pre-Brown Girl Green, pre-BGG, as you would say, big part of it was burning out during college, doing all this work in this field, feeling like it was going nowhere, feeling very lost. I burned out. I didn't really want to even do this anymore. I remember just being like, I'm going to go to law school. And that burnout lasted for about a year or so. But during that time, that's when I was like, let me get to know myself and what I care about and what I like to do as a person, living my life, not to feel like I'm sacrificing who I am in the name of this quote unquote movement, you know? And so I was like, okay, let me explore that. And during that time, that's when I learned I loved poetry. I loved storytelling. I loved art. I loved connecting with people in a way through interviews and media. And it was the first time someone had said, hey, I think you'd be a really good journalist or a writer or, you know, a media creator. And that's when I started exploring it. I was like, yeah, I could do that. Why not? I love my favorite YouTubers. I love documentary filmmakers. This seems like something that feels like it brings me a lot of joy. And I kind of just followed that voice more than I'm not doing enough or, oh, nothing matters. I can't accomplish anything in this space. Let me be curious. And it led me down this path of really finding out that like Brown Girl Green and the discovery of it and the creation of it was a form of self-care. It was a form of me getting a chance to be honest that I was pissed off about the environmental fields and the people I met and the spaces I was in that made me feel so small. And I was like, I'm angry and I want a space to say something about it. I personally think Brown Girl Green in itself is an evolving platform as a form of self-care. There's times where I've had horrible weeks and I will make a piece of content and it's like the one thing that like actually made me remind myself that like I can have fun and get out of my brain of overthinking about things. And I think that that has allowed me to feel more grounded in the work that I do because it's operating out of a space of me feeling whole about myself rather than trying to fight to prove myself, if that makes sense. Because it's like, no, I created Brown Girl Green because this is me being enough. It's a constant battle, though, because as things have grown and people don't know that original story of why that is, people have constantly tried to put me in a box. Oh, you don't match X, Y, and Z thing of what we think an environmentalist is. Oh, why don't you talk about that issue? Oh, why are you talking about it this way? And when it comes to that with self-care, that's kind of the wave I'm in now. I'm trying to figure out how can I set boundaries around my work, around my heart, around my personal life. So that way I can show up wholly to Brown Girl Green as a space, but also be able to be Christy, you know? And some of those things get blurred because I am Brown Girl Green, but it's like I also like to have my own life outside of that. That allows me to, again, connect with myself. so I don't lose that path that I was just talking about earlier. And so I would say self-care is a consistent path of trying to like refine yourself again, or at least the aspects that bring you comfort and make you feel connected in the moment to like what you're doing and who you are.
I can empathize with this tremendously. On the music side, I think about what I do performing in front of people and through social media, sharing certain aspects of my life. But I'm still a human. I'm still a person, and I have thoughts and feelings. And yeah, I read all the YouTube comments. Come on, we see everything that's going on there. Like, yeah. What do you think? That's going into a void and it's not for the people that you're writing to? It's insane. So yes, I completely empathize with having these two pieces and trying to find the bond between them and the relationship between them. And relationships are something that you are really interested in because they provide this new and different metaphor for talking about the climate crisis. So you're working on a series called Loving Climate Change, and you want to explore the relationship between relationships and activism. And you've said that in both, you need to be vulnerable and flexible and willing to compromise. What is your goal with this project? And first of all, I love it. I think using metaphors like this are great methods of communication. But what's your ultimate goal with this project?
I mean, I actually started it last summer, and because of my own taking self-care seriously, I've taken my time on it, but I'm still working on it, which I really like. And the original concept was just wanting to really humanize some of the people that we see in the climate movement. So some of the people that are featured that I interviewed were like climate activists and their partners. So actually understanding, what does that look like? What has that experience been? I also interviewed my close friends to ask them, like, what's been the experience of witnessing me go through this whole experience of Brown Girl Green? And then I interviewed a mother and her child. So asking her, what is she worried about? And what is her child worried about? So it's been a really interesting journey since I created those episodes last summer, and I'm now still in the production phase of it, to really like understand, how do we get real about these issues? Why is it such an uncomfortable, taboo topic? And I really want to explore like why we think that is. How do we challenge that? And I also obviously incorporated aspects of the racial justice and gender justice aspects into it too. How is the destruction of the planet connected to these broader systems of oppression? And how are these systems of oppression kind of in counterbalance to like the true love and connection we feel with the people around us? What is that tension, and why is it so hard for us to talk about it?
I love that, because you're doing the same thing that we talked about earlier, contextualizing it in people's larger lives, because there is no one on this planet that the only thing that they do is think about the climate crisis. Of course, it is obviously a crisis, and that's why we call it a crisis, but there are other things in the world that people have to think about too. So I love that you're contextualizing this conversation in something larger. I do want to ask one more thing before we wrap up, and it's kind of circling back to the beginning where we started. So you've built a platform for yourself, and there are other communities out there that help to elevate Black and Indigenous and Asian and Latinx and other narratives and actions in the climate crisis. So we're starting to see more of these people have a voice, both online and in person. However, we are only at the very beginning of seeing this in the corporate space and in the policy space. How can we take the successes that you and others have had in the digital space and move it over to make sure that corporations and policymakers are using this same approach?
I mean, I think a key part of it is definitely holding those companies accountable. I think a big thing that's starting to emerge is the concept of advisory boards. So companies who are now trying to find diverse groups of people to come in and give advice on like their strategic plans and being able to figure out how to include them more. So I think more companies need to figure out how to like find the budgeting and be able to make that happen. I think also in the policy space, I know that like there's now the interagency council like for environmental justice in the White House, which is awesome, with folks that like I know, which is even cooler. But we need more of that. We need more people who are like supporting bills and legislation that is going to be supported and advocated by that group. So I think people should definitely read up on what environmental justice policy or bills are actually being discussed right now in Congress, and actually contact your representatives to really prioritize that. There needs to be more incubators that provide opportunities for Black, Indigenous, and people of color to like be in politics, to get into these environmental companies and organizations. Because as much as you can bring them in, whether or not they're going to want to stay in the environment you create for them is a whole different story. And so my question always is, how can we continue to like demand that there is those gaps, and to like make sure that that's known by as many people as possible? And then, you know, ideally be able to like have that shift where those resources could be redistributed.
That's incredible. I couldn't agree more. I want to hear, very last thing, where can people hear more of what you're working on, more of what you're doing?
Yeah, thank you everyone for listening today. I'm Kristy Drutman again. You can find me on the Brown Girl Green podcast. I'm also Brown Girl Green on social media, and my website is browngirlgreen.org.
This has been so inspiring and so interesting and creative, and I really love everything you're doing that we talked about today, and many of the things that we didn't even get to talk about today that you're doing on and offline. So thank you for all of your work in the climate space and beyond, and particularly around contextualizing it in the larger scope of people's lives. I think that's so incredibly important. It was lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Since we are a nonprofit, any little bit of funding helps us to bring you more episodes like this one. Today's episode would not have been possible without our amazing team. Producer and editor, Shelby Kaufman, and associate producer and engineer, Sophie Yu. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.